This podcast is hosted by Chris Finkston and Spencer Oliver. They are both experienced paramedics. They've done everything from 911 ground ambulance to volunteer fire department work and are both currently flight paramedics. This podcast reviews scenarios based on real calls run by real out-of-hospital clinicians. Details are changed to protect the privacy of those involved and to present educational opportunities to the listener. This podcast is EMS 2020. Hey, everybody. Welcome to EMS 2020. We are back for another episode. Thank you, everyone, for listening to us. As always, this episode is going to be fun. They're always fun. This one's a little bit scary. I don't know. I think it's going to be hard. I'm in the hot seat, as always. And we're going to fix that soon. We'll put Spencer back in the hot seat. I know he's the better of the two of us anyway. You guys keep telling us to hurt my feelings. So, yeah, I'm going to make him earn it. So
it's just going to be, all it's going to be is just diabetic emergencies, and I'll fuck it up. We're bringing you like a five in a row, and each one will be like, oh, man, Spencer, you should have checked a CBG.
Yeah, this is all going to be CBG checks, and you'll miss them all in a row. So yeah, if you're going to earn that, I don't know. I think it's pity fandom. But
probably.
Anyway,
they feel bad for the apparition that isn't a real person.
Right?
They're like, man, exactly. That computer generated person looks sad. Let's boost their confidence.
I think I get more comments on fake Spencer than I do like anything else as of late. Still not buying it. So. And it doesn't help that we kind of look the same.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, we don't look like the same, but we're about a deep fake away from each other. Like, there's enough similarities, physical similarities between the two of us that it's not a hard stretch for anybody moderately gifted in like CG to make me look like Spencer or
vice versa.
To make me look different and make fake Spencer. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. With that, guys, also follow us on social media. Like I mentioned, we have an Instagram account. That's EMS 2020 Show on Instagram. Facebook, EMS 20/20 is on Facebook. And if you want your call to be featured on this podcast, then send it to EMS2020podcast@gmail.com. That is going to be changing soon to info@EMS2020podcast.com. You can actually use that email address now and it'd be fine. But in the meantime, keep using the old one if you can. Otherwise, I don't know. There you go. There's some confusion. But you have two emails to choose from. But yeah, all that stuff's going to be changing. We do have a website coming on the way. Also, head over to our merch store on TeePublic. There's a link on all of our social media to get there. You can get shirts that say things. Right now, it says EMS 2020, but I'm hoping there's some more stuff on the way. It'd be some funnier stuff.
There's definitely some interesting stuff coming. Something about a peanut butter spider sandwich. I oof.
Right. It's a very requested shirt. Oh, yeah. God. All right. So also, I do want to tell you guys, your guys' response to the merch store has been amazing. It was so good that the people who run the merch store actually reached out to us to help us make new designs. So that says a lot. So you guys have inspired them to keep this thing going. So it's done very well for the podcast. It's a great way to support us. With that, let's kind of move into a little bit of listener feedback.
I felt like you were, juggling that word. It was like,
right. It's like the L dropped out of my mouth and I was trying to keep it from hitting the floor. And I kept like tossing it. You know,
I felt like your foot probably like went out a little bit and like kicked it just to kind of break its fall before it hit the ground. You know, like it was impressive.
No, it didn't survive. That's true. But let's kind of move on to a little bit of some feedback. So on our last episode, we had a really sick kid that had a respiratory S-word virus, syncytial virus. Was a sick kid, and there were some problematic parents that were just not, they were not down with the sickness, as you could say. They're not down with helping out EMS. Oh. And that ended up being... They were very disturbed.
I just had like theme envy all of a sudden, like theme regret. Like,
right?
Wow.
Just your disturbed songs.
I could have done down with the sickness, and now I'm sad. I went with whatever the fucking shitty theme I chose.
But we asked you guys for your feedback on how do you approach parents that are kind of on that border between being a help or being obstructive because of their anxiety levels. And Rob Taylor ended up commenting and saying, in relation to your new episode about talking to parents, I couldn't help but notice some parallels to what's taught to some of us in law enforcement. And I love this response, by the way, to law enforcement about working with patients in emotional or mental crisis, which we see in EMS regularly. A couple things that work really well that I have had numerous success with starts with rapport. Stop being a medic, EMT, firefighter, cop. Be a human. And by the way, I love that sentence right there.
Yeah.
I think that's gold.
That's the goal. Yeah, for sure.
It is. It really is. They go on to give an example saying, hi, my name is XYZ and I'm going to help you or your child. Can you tell me what's going on today? This is disarming and sets an early expectation that you can deliver on in some way. The next thing is expectation setting and boundaries. You have to establish clear boundaries and set expectations, but you can't do that unless you have trust and rapport built. Building rapport should never stop throughout the entire interaction, even while setting boundaries and expectations. It looks like, and this is another example, I am so sorry you're having a rough day or night with your child, and I'm sure you're concerned. It's always scary to call 911, but I'm really glad you did. Even if the call is nothing.
Yeah.
This gives the parent or patient reassurance that they did the right thing and further gives you more power to deliver that I'm here to help expectation. And then setting the expectation looks like not giving an alternative option so the brain doesn't question it. The more options you provide, the more resistance you can be met with. Limit the options. That looks like, hey, we should go to the hospital. Do you want to go or do you want dad to go? I like that. Start giving options. This limits the options. Now, the option of going to the hospital is removed and the parent's / patient's mind, it's not in question anymore. This doesn't always work though. So the option becomes mom or dad going with kiddo, not are we even going to go to the hospital? The next part is establishing the boundary. Now that you have rapport and trust and you've set expectations like your baby is going to start crying, so just, you know, expect that and such. Now start setting boundaries by limiting options again, such as, hey, before entering the ambulance, say something like, hey, I'll take kiddo and get them buckled in. Can you go with my partner and they will get you situated up front? This eliminates the option. Granted, the parent may ask, then you can explain policy also. Another great method is just telling the truth exactly how it is once you have the rapport and saying, mom, I need you to write up front because if things go poorly, I need to be able to help your son and help him in the best way. So in the best interest of your son's treatment, I need to have you write up front. Obviously, every call is different, but honestly, sticking to these things have helped me so much in my law enforcement and EMS career. So one, rapport and early expectation setting. Two, limiting the options. Three, supporting forward good choices, not responding to unfavorable answers as a tactic can work also. Setting boundaries, support, and let them know everything will be okay. So I kind of have some brief thoughts on this. This is a really good response. Now, I know a couple of people might be listening and having heard that last episode and be like, yeah, but when the mom was out there, like by the time she was out there, she was kind of on fire to like be with this kid. I don't know that that tactic would have worked. And you're probably right. But I think the key here, and as was mentioned by this listener, is that you've got to establish rapport early. By the time our crew had gotten out to the ambulance in the last call, I think we were kind of too far gone. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah,
rapport had been in asystole for about 10 minutes with no compressions. And
yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, that's a perfect metaphor.
Yeah. Right.
Visual. You know? I don't know. Yeah, it's perfect. Perfect. Yeah.
I mean, you can try, you know, the bilateral decompressions for this trauma code, but, you know, it's more practice at that point.
Yeah, one of the things that stuck out to me is the, you know, like when you present two options that are actually very limiting, but they don't seem that way. And that's a really good tactic for children.
Very good.
You know, when you're like, you know, it's like, hey, when you're like, hey, we need to give you blow by, which side do you want this mask on? This side or this side? And then it's funny because you know, adults would be like, well, I don't fucking want it. So no. But kids, they're like, oh, I get a little option here. I get a little autonomy. All right, I'll the left side. And then you get to hold it there. And they've picked something that they didn't want. You know, it's like,
exactly.
When you want your kid to put on your shoes, like, do you want the left shoe on or the right shoe on? Notice you're not giving them the option of You're not wearing shoes. You're just giving them two options to kind of start with. And they
exactly,
and it kind of works. Yeah.
Now, I would say this does have some impact on parents as well. I mean, I wouldn't do something as basic as left shoe or right shoe because they'll probably see right through that.
Come on, Mom. Which shoe are you putting on first?
But as the listener had mentioned earlier, kind of one of the things, and I really like their example of, hey, so when you take your child to the hospital, do you want to go or does dad want to go? It's a decision that ultimately matters very, very little. To us as EMS responders.
Yeah.
But it is probably a decision that's important to them that they need to make. So, because that is an important decision. Okay. Which one of us is going to go? Because then the other one has to do some stuff. That's an important decision to make.
Yeah.
And it kind of puts them in the mindset of making a decision, feel like they have input, at the same time validates their reason for calling 911. And a third point moves the call in the direction it needs to move. So I loved that example.
That's a perfect example, and exactly for the reasons you said. Because one, yeah, it rolls with it. It says like, hey, I know you. One of you wants to go, and like we need to go. And then it does present that like, I'm giving, all right, we are going with that option, the thing that you wanted to do. But, you know, it gives them the hard choice without, you know, but again, now they're working with you. There's that cooperation instead of you, you know, going like you can't come or one person can't come.
Right.
You know, it's a perfect way to deliver that. Exactly.
And I think like, you know, these subtle deliveries of supporting them, validating their emotions towards calling, validating their decision to call, building those up from the start is going to make those harder sells. Like, hey, I need you to write over. Cause I admit as a parent, I want to be in the back with my kid.
Yeah.
You know, like, especially as someone who reviews 911 calls for a living and sees how bad they can go. Like that's, it kind of makes me want to be in the back now. On that note, just so you guys know, it may seem like there's a lot of calls that go bad in order for us to maintain a weekly show. Hundreds of thousands of calls are run each and every month, and we can only seem to find four to talk about. So just know that in general, you guys do a great job, especially those that listen to this show. But anyway, that said, I think this was just awesome in terms of building rapport and kind of moving the call forward in the right way. So where you can get, when it comes to those harder things where, hey, like you need to sit up front, those kind of things, that is where it really like is going to shine. So build up to where the harder conversations are easier. With that, we got to move on. So, hey, Rob Taylor, thank you for sending us that message. Spot on, man.
Yeah.
Spot on.
Also, love the, I love that law enforcement is doing this. So I'm glad that this is happening. You know, like that, this is a big focus. That also makes me happy.
And it's one of those things where, you know, I think, you know, like, especially nowadays, that there's a lot of negativity towards law enforcement.
Yeah.
And so I think it is refreshing to see someone with a history in law enforcement kind of shows like, no, actually, like, humans first. Don't be the EMS. Don't be the cop. Be a human. And so to hear that from our law enforcement side and be able to talk about that, I think is a very positive thing that we can put out there.
Hell yeah.
So on to the call.
All right. So this story is brought to us by Special Customs Agent Dave Kujan, who in real life is not a Special Customs Agent. They are actually
Nor named Dave Kujan.
They're actually a paramedic with 6 years of experience. They have what I'd call a rather wide swath of experience with like private ambulance companies, a small transporting fire department, and then a larger transporting fire department. Their partners for the shift are going to be partnered with LAPD Sergeant Jeff Rabin, who in real life is not a police sergeant, but a full-time firefighter paramedic, and FBI agent Jack Baer, who in real life is actually a paramedic intern on their first day of internship.
Oh, shit. So, if you're a new listener, by the way, we make all these names up usually based on TV shows that we like. That's about it. I am waiting for that day where there's going to be a paramedic named Jeff Rabin who's going to be like, how the fuck did they get this call? Or someone's going to be like, dude, I know Jeff Rabin. But anyway, Jack Baer, is this 24? Is that the theme?
No. Because Jack Bauer wasn't an FBI agent, right? He was
Gotcha. Oh, this is Jack. How's his name spelled? Like Baer, like a grizzly bear?
B-A-E-R. Baer.
Right, I am lost. Let's see if I can pick it up later on. All right, so.
Cool. All right, so let's talk about the system that they're working in.
Really quick. So our cast is Dave. Dave is a PIC, paramedic on the call. Jeff, their paramedic partner. Jack is the paramedic intern.
Perfect. Yeah, that's all right. That's it exactly. All right. So this crew operates a transporting rescue for a large fire department. They work 24-hour shifts. They tend to run between 4 and 6 transports per shift, and that's just transports. They can go on other assignments that don't involve transporting as well. They work medic on the unit, and they trade off when they run calls. I'd go more into their system, but the more important thing to know is that there's a neighboring fire department which also provides ambulance transports. And that fire department is undergoing staffing problems. And so Dave's service will often be tasked with covering that area and providing mutual aid when the levels drop for that area. And so we'll get into hospitals and such when we get into the call. But those are really kind of the big pieces here that we need to know for this system. So on to the call. And our story actually starts at the end.
Ooh.
Special agent. Okay. Yeah. Special agent Dave reflects on the evidence given to him by all the usual suspected field diagnoses. Any of which could be responsible for the most recent patient's condition. Which of the many options would be his Kaiser Sosa? And as he looks around and pieces together the stories that each of the suspects told him, it suddenly dawns on him. And now, let's start the call. Go back in time.
Jesus.
It's a little after 9 a.m. on a clear but cold day. Special Agent Paramedic Dave is on shift with his partner, Sergeant Jeff, of the Paramedic Department. I don't have much there. And they are joined by FPI Agent Jack.
What is FPI? Did you say FPI?
Yes, I did say FPI. FPI, okay. Because FPI didn't make a lot of sense. I'm changing it on the fly to... FPI, which stands for Fresh Paramedic Intern.
Nice.
All right. So they're just... you can expect more of this. All right.
I can expect more of your bullshit. I know that.
They are dispatched to investigate a vehicle that left the road on a 2-lane highway. The call they're about to investigate takes place pretty far from them because this is actually a mutual aid response, and it's on the opposite side of their neighboring department's service area. So they depart lights and sirens, and Dave reads through the dispatch notes as they get going and as those start coming in. So the notes are, upright vehicle, off the road, may have driven into a pole. As this is FPI Agent Jack's first call of the day on their first day of their internship, most of the discussion that took place en route to this call was centered on just kind of making sure that, like, Jack knew what to expect, kind of how the flow would go, you know, what kind of things they would do. You know, Dave was like, hey, you're not going to be like PIC on this call, you know, so there's no pressure here. Dave strongly felt that, like, based on the notes, this was probably going to end up being a non-injury accident. But, you know, they are continued code 3, and it takes them about 20 minutes or so to get to the scene. When they arrive, they find the following. There is an SUV about 30 yards off the road in a field, and it's resting its nose against a telephone pole. The vehicle is upright, there's no obvious damage to the outside of the vehicle, and there's a fire department crew that's on scene attending to it. Some other details that might be important. This is a 2-lane highway with a speed limit of about 45 miles an hour. There is a small embankment and a shallow ditch that run alongside the road. But beyond that is a very flat, large, but muddy field.
I hate working in mud.
Right?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Your feet sink. Can't get out of there, but you got to be there. And then the back of the ambulance looks like shit when you're done. Anyway.
Yeah, no, true.
Yeah. All right.
Hashtag.
Moving on.
First world paramedic problems.
Well, it's true, I guess.
All right. So one of the volunteer firefighters greets the responding rescue as the crew is getting out of the rig, and they give them a quick report. But as this moment doesn't really fit the theme, I'm now going to give it a little Hollywood treatment. So here we go.
Okay.
Yeah. Dave gets out of the police cruiser ambulance and then crushes their lit cigarette under the heel of their shoe. They remove their sunglasses in, like, Hollywood cop fashion. They look to a nearby uniform blue, You there. Who's in charge here? Oh, Chris, hold on. You got to play the uniform blue for this scene.
I'll give it a go.
Okay.
I guess I can.
All right. Well, you can tell, well, I'll give it a go. I guess I can. They're not in charge anymore. And by the way, I'm showing you my badge now. So you need to respect my authority.
The look of respect is on my face.
Yeah.
I don't have any lines in this. What am I supposed to do?
That was your line. You were just to say who's in charge. And then you said, well, I guess I could. And so that's the person who's in charge.
Okay, sweet.
But not anymore, because I'm here. I being Special Customs Agent Dave Kujins. And then I'll introduce Sergeant Jeff Rahman is here. And then this is FBI Agent Jack. And we're taking over this investigation. Now, give us the details. All right, so cutting back to reality, here's the information.
I don't think my role was necessary in any of that.
No, it was.
Okay, perfect. I feel like I'm the guy that's like on the set, so the actor who's pretty much acting like in a green suit against a green screen has someone to act to. Like, I think that's my only role. I was just there so you had a physical person in your mind to talk to as you did this. That was it.
You're the foam ball.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, this is coming from a guy who made up a robot host to do a podcast with, so I get it, but.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. All right. So back to reality. Here's the information they are given. This vehicle went off a road. There are two occupants, both elderly. There is minimal damage to their vehicle. Both occupants were restrained with seatbelts. The female passenger seems totally fine, but the male passenger, in the driver's seat, doesn't look good, and they can't get a blood pressure on him. This gentleman holds up a rhythm strip for Dave. Dave sees the rhythm strip, which I'll add in here, like they didn't have for us to see. But what they see is a rate of about 125 with a kind of a wide rhythm. And they immediately thought like, ooh, I bet this patient has a ventricular pacer. So Dave and his crew announced that they will go right to the male passenger and see what's going on, as that would appear to be the priority patient from the information they have. So they head down the small embankment, make their way through the mud, and over to the driver's side, where an elderly male patient is sitting. As they approach, Dave can clearly see there's a small dent in the front of the vehicle from where it, like, touched the pole, and there is airbag deployment, but they don't see any other significant findings for the vehicle, at least. The patient.
Okay.
Yep. And their thought is like, this seems like the car went off the road and then just was slowed down significantly as it traveled through the mud and then, you know, came to stop at the pole. The patient is described as an 80-year-old male, approximately 6 foot tall, 100 kilograms, sitting upright in the driver's seat. The patient appears pale and diaphoretic and is cool to the touch. Dave greets the patient and notes that the patient is alert and oriented, but is just slow in responding. And when I talked to Dave about it, they said it would just take the patient a while to answer when asked questions. And he was just very short in their responses. The patient would answer, you know, in 1 to 2 brief words. And here's what they say. The patient reports that they are having chest pain. By the way, it is noted that the patient does have a pacemaker. The patient is on the monitor in the car. They have a rate of 125, a BP of ? over triple question marks, and an SpO2 that isn't reading. Now, further details from the patient are hard to get at the moment, and as the patient appears acutely ill, their partner Jeff even made a point like, man, that guy looks sick. You know, and that's like the NREMT, like sick versus not sick. You know?
Yeah.
So they decide like, hey, let's get the patient out of this vehicle and into the ambulance ASAP. Also, one of the uniform blues is the volunteer uniform blues is actually a firefighter for Dave's department who volunteers with this other agency. So that fire paramedic goes to get a better history from the spouse, as the patient isn't really a good historian on that at this point. More on those findings in a moment. So Dave's current priority, again, is to get the patient to the ambulance, but the field is really too muddy to allow them, like the cot, to come down near the vehicle so they can just move the patient over. And given the patient's presentation, they're unlikely to be able to make that journey on foot. So the crew
through the mud.
Yeah, exactly.
Because if he gets stuck.
So the crew elect to use a mega mover to carry the patient over to the ambulance. And by the way, that's after they did the quick like palpation of the patient's neck and back. Patient didn't have any reports of like pain with any of that. So the patient was able to stand up from the vehicle, and the crew did a standing takedown onto the mega mover, with Dave keenly aware that earlier that shift, they had been joking with their intern about how standing takedowns aren't really a thing anymore. So
yeah. I was about to say, like, to the point that I almost feel like I should explain what it is, but basically standing takedown, because it sounds like a finishing move. Like, that's what it sounds like.
It does.
Like, right? Yeah, I performed a standing takedown. Basically means I kicked him in the throat and collapsed his trachea is what it sounds like. But yeah. It's basically, yeah, where you have someone who's standing up and you put a backboard, you stand up a backboard behind them, and then you just lean them back onto the backboard as it goes down the ground, with, of course, the support of everybody else. You're not just like shoving them into a backboard and having them land flat. Like, it's not.
It's like a trust exercise, except like there's stuff behind you, like from the start.
Yeah. There's no drop. No one's catching you. You're just going all the way down. But yeah, that's pretty much a standing takedown, but we don't do them a whole lot.
Yeah. So the patient is carried over 30 yards of mud with the mega mover, and there's no change in their condition. They get to their ambulance. They set the patient on the cot and load him into the ambulance, and all three partners jump into the rescue to start really looking at clues into solving this crime. The crime being, what field diagnosis is responsible for causing the patient to present this way?
Mm-hmm.
So Jeff immediately gets the patient on the monitor. That's the EKG, autocuff, and SpO2. FPI agent Jack is assigned to establishing IV access, and Dave gets report from the volunteer firefighter who talked to the female occupant as the patient is still just kind of giving them the bare minimum in responses. So here's the report from that uniform blue, and they're going to be their name because they're important to the story now. And also, I ran out of officer names. So, sorry. All right, so here's what they said to Dave. The wife says they were driving to the doctor's appointment. The patient has a recent history of pneumonia, and this was a follow-up appointment to see how they were progressing in those treatments. They report that the patient, while driving, seemed to have multiple syncopal events, including this last one, in which he left the roadway.
Hey, pro tip. You should stop driving after the first syncopal event. It's not like, all right, best out of three. Let's see, like, let's not.
Let it ride. No, this all is right, fine. Man, I'm doing good.
If you have three laps of consciousness while driving this automobile, then I'm calling it.
Yeah, that was actually, I did have to stop our interview briefly to just be like, what the fuck? Like, why? Like,
multiple.
I have so many questions.
Like, I've been driving for, you know, 62 years.
Oh.
You're not going to tell me how to drive now.
For every man, there's a woman who's like, please don't fucking kill us sitting in a passenger seat. Just going like, God damn it. All right. So that's the story that they have from the wife. Assessment-wise, here's what we have. We have a male patient who is alert, but, you know, kind of lethargic, slow, or as I say, like, they seem to be focused on just keeping themselves alive. And our questions are distracting. That's sort of what I got out of this. Yeah.
Gotcha.
He's like,
we're distracting him. Okay.
We're distracting him by asking questions, and he's just like, yeah, I'm using all my energy just to exist. Stay in existence. Mm-hmm. Laying with supine on a stretcher, he remains pale, diaphoretic, and cool to the touch. There are no outward signs of trauma. He's able to move all extremities well. And here are the vitals for this time. So the heart rate is 124, and the EKG rhythm like matches the strip that was handed to them. The patient is placed on an end-tidal CO2 cannula to monitor respirations as they appeared faster than normal, and also they want to give a little bit of supplemental O2 because their SpO2 monitor isn't reading. So the end-tidal CO2 comes back at 11, and Dave feels that this low number is likely because they are administering O2 through it. I have thoughts. It kind of depends on the end-tidal cannula that you have, because, like, as it turns out, the mouthpiece, like, it doesn't measure through the tubes that oxygen is blowing out of. It measures through a completely different spot. There's, you know, like, in fact, yeah, they're completely separated. So like you can have a high amount of O2 flowing in and it shouldn't alter the end tidal too much. What could alter the end tidal is if the patient's laying supine and that mouthpiece isn't like catching their, you know, exhalation through their mouth. Cause there's that little, you know, like dip that catches it all, and does the sampling. That's what I found. Or, you know, like, I don't know, his blood pressure might be really low. And it is, it's 78 over 51. So that could also make kind of a lower end tidal too. But anyway, respirations are 22. So again, heart rate's 124, end tidal's 11, respirations are 22, BP is 78 over 51 via the autocuff. All right. And so, a 12 lead was being performed, and Chris, I'm sending you that 12 lead right now so you can see what comes back. And for those of you on our social media, you're also getting a chance to look. I hope that I remembered to put it up. So there's that. And while you're looking, guys, I'm going to introduce everyone to the usual suspects that Dave has lined up to explain who is causing this crime.
And it all came right through, so I'm looking at it as you go through this.
Perfect. So first up on the list of suspects, we have Todd the Trauma.
Wrong. I'm kidding. Just keep going.
Trauma's widely known for their very blunt personality, but don't think that he won't cut you deep. Trauma usually isn't known for being discreet. This animal is a fan of leaving calling cards to let every provider know it was there. Blood, bruising, swelling, deformities. But Todd the Trauma can also play tricky. I mean, let's look at his criminal history. It's littered with times it's killed patients by creating distractions that pulls providers' attention away from the real problem. Mangle an arm bad enough and everyone panics over it. Well, they miss the tension pneumo that's really killing my victim. Heh, works like a charm. But that's not their only move. You know, given the right opportunity, it can kill via overlooked internal bleeding. Point is, Todd's an asshole. All right, moving on. All that right. One over there in this lineup, that's old Sepsis Fenster.
Yeah.
You should see the things that he can do to a body with the right infectious material. And if you don't catch him and that shit goes systemic, woo-wee. Sepsis Fenster is a madman when it comes to infection. And patient as hell. I mean, he could just he can just wait until the right moment to overload the body's defense systems. He's just there waiting, biding his time. Oh yeah, hold on. This one's important. Next on our lineup is M.I. Keaton. A former good heart turned bad. Somewhere along the line, MI just decided he'd rather not be a good beat cop or a heart, good beat heart. MI will watch as the light drains from your eyes as he deprives your cardiac cells of blood with his blockages. So those are the usual suspects, Chris. Which do you think is the criminal mastermind here?
I'm not going to answer that question until I give you a round of applause on your theme. This is amazing. And I thought my color crown box was a pretty good theme. And I thought like my animal wheel was a good theme. Those are good themes in terms of like humor, but not only does this have humor, like it plays so well into actually being a paramedic, but like evaluating the usual suspects and kind of like, kind of moving through. All right. So which one do I think, is leading up? So, just kind of going through the possibilities here. So starting with trauma, I think trauma is probably our least likely. But again, like we do need to cut and expose that chest. We don't need to cut the chest. Sorry, cut the clothes. Expose. Just slash it right open. Yeah, we just get some rib spreaders. Yeah, apparently I'm the fourth usual suspect. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, we need to take a look at it. I would like to think that was done when we did a 12 lead, but I will say from experience, never assume that. 12 leads can often be placed, like there's a lot of people who are really good at placing them or really bad at placing them. They don't realize it, but where, you know, they can reach up if you have someone who, you know, that's only a 200 pound male, or actually 220 pound male that's over 6 feet. So palpable ribs possibly. So it could be, someone could easily like place this by doing the whole, like, you know, move the shirt around kind of thing. So sure. Make sure you actually get a good look at that shirt. If you're going the trauma route, chest trauma route, make sure you're going to be looking at that actual chest, because we do have a dysrhythmia to deal with here by looking at that 12 lead. I won't give it away what's exactly on the 12 lead, but,
okay.
And then back to, so anyways, yeah. So trauma, I think it's least likely, especially considering the mechanism is that bad. We also have someone else in the car who's apparently fine. Although I'm curious what they have to say about the mechanism, because they'll be a good indicator too, because they can also tell you like, yeah, I just kind of, he was out and it rolled to a stop and then bumped, you know, for his fourth syncopal event on the ride home. On his first one, he actually managed to make it through a drive-thru in order before waking back up. But in this case, anyway, so moving on, the next thing is sepsis, what'd you call it? Sepsis what?
Fenster.
Sepsis Fenster. Traumatod, yeah. Now we're on to Sepsis Fenster. So sepsis, I mean, it's totally a possibility. I mean, in fact, like, sepsis really has to be on the mind all the time because it can cause so many things. But I mean, again, I would want to know things like temperature, and I want to know like a history. I believe patients being treated for pneumonia recently, correct? And they were getting a follow-up on that. So yeah, so sepsis is definitely a candidate. So I would look at other things. I know our blood pressure, I believe our last BP was ??
78 over 58, I believe, was the last one that they just had. Yeah.
Or oh, shoe
78
balls,
over 51. So
yeah. 78 over 51. So, you know, given the history, I would want to know if the patient's febrile. That could definitely be a problem, and it could lead to multiple syncopal episodes if we have a borderline blood pressure that's getting worse and worse, you know. So it's a concern, but again, I'd want to know that temp, see if there is a temp or the patient, or if the patient has had a temp. And then the final thing is, I don't know the name yet for that guy either, but M.I.
Keaton.
M.I. Keaton. The good beat heart turned bad. That to me is going to be kind of a front runner as well. Though looking at the 12 lead, I think while all those things are important, I think my treatment path is kind of determined based off that, and I would probably worry about the whys here in a little bit, but that's just kind of
okay.
That's my thought on it. So,
all right,
yeah.
I agree. I think given sort of the mechanism here with the trauma, it seems low, but you know, like it's an older patient. Yeah, we don't know what medications he's on. He might take blood thinners, so like it might be more susceptible even with like the lower mechanism. Yeah. But you know, I think I move kind of away from trauma a little bit, given that there's, you know, the series of syncopal episodes that preceded the what would be the trauma or, you know, the cause. You know, so that would sort of be where I kind of go like, yeah, I don't think this is trauma, at least from this. You know, who knows, maybe he fell earlier or something. That might be something to figure out. Sepsis, I agree. I'm like, yeah, if he's got a history of sepsis or a history of pneumonia, and like maybe the treatments haven't been working,
and he's hypotensive and tachycardic.
And we're looking for a fever, but sometimes in some patients, especially like older patients, I believe they can actually be like not hypothermic, but they'll actually be like kind of lower than normal, which I guess would be kind of hypothermic. They'd be a little, you know, they might be not febrile with an infection too.
Yeah, very so, true. I mean, a patient being afebrile does not rule out sepsis whatsoever. And I believe the way it goes is most your septic patients will have a history of being febrile, but then by the time they're in septic shock, it's totally plausible that they are no longer febrile by the time you get there, because you kind of see that infection rise. One other thing I forgot to mention that I'd want for M.I. Keaton would be the presence of chest pain or dyspnea. Dyspnea I want to know in any of these things, especially with the history of pneumonia, but I'd want to know the presence of chest pain, which...
And by the way, the patient did, that was their first complaint, was chest pain, which also seems kind of weird from the...
Am I just not paying attention? Did you say that too?
I did.
I missed a blood pressure and a chief complaint. Perfect. I'm doing well.
Yeah.
I'm on this.
Yep. Yeah. That. It's coming. Life comes at you fast sometimes, man.
It does.
All right. Yeah. And to that point, chest pain seems kind of potentially weird, like a weird fit for sepsis, but you know, I don't know, like pneumonia, hypotension, you know, maybe his heart's cranky with it. But MI, and here's where MI, because again, now everyone's got the chance to see the 12 lead, and Dave is also getting a chance to see it. And Jeff, who ran the 12 lead, says like, hey, this 12 lead says STEMI.
Mm-hmm. It does. Okay. When we say it says STEMI in that the automatic, the 12, in the machine's opinion, it's a STEMI. That's what it's printing out saying STEMI alert meets criteria.
So, you know, that's sort of where, you know, that is a big suspect here as well. But I think you brought up already, you're like, I think there are more suspects that we should include. And so here we are. I'm going to include them. Okay. So yeah, there's a rather awkward figure in the corner. Yeah.
I want to make my one consistent point that I've made in this show. There is no reason that it couldn't be any combination or all three of these. Just always keep that in mind. It is entirely plausible that this patient is sepsis. And here's one thing you got to remember about sepsis and why sepsis sucks is sepsis puts an incredible strain on the body. If you have a heart that's already not doing too great and then you become septic and now that heart suddenly has the job of trying to maintain pressure when it's been third spacing volume because you're a septic patient, that's not good for cardiac tissue because it's going to increase the oxygen demand. There is no reason at all that this patient could not be both sepsis, both septic and having a cardiac event as a result of the increased workload on the heart. It's also entirely plausible that the patient, that there's no if you have a clot that's gunning for a coronary artery, it's not going to stop being like, hey guys, he's already septic. Let's give him a break. Let's let him get through the sepsis, then I'll clog a coronary artery. There's reason that all these things can't happen. And there's, so anyway, just kind of bear that in mind as you go down these things.
And I want to jump in here real quick because let me see if I can split this here. It's almost like these guys could all work together. But there's one thing, just like in a movie, maybe titled something similar to this. Just like in the movie, there is really one here that is trying to like actively kill the patient right at this moment. So let's introduce these other characters. All right. So we've got that rather awkward figure in the corner. Ventricular arrhythmia Kent. Roger, ventricular arrhythmia Kent. Kent did get rounded up with these others, but is really low on Dave's suspects list. And I'll explain why in a moment. But I'm also going to add this guy in. This is kind of a personal thing. It doesn't sound like this suspect was considered, but it's my story and I'm adding him in anyway. So standing on the other end of the cell, away from all the suspects, with a smug look that could only really rival that of a Baldwin brother, is Metabolic McManus. Now, Metabolic McManus doesn't often work alone and usually accompanies like sepsis or DKA or overdoses or, you know, hell, even trauma. But this scumbag can't be overlooked. He'll skewer your metabolic panel in delightful ways through a variety of methods. He'll do acidosis, alkalosis, hyper-K in any way, through direct routes or in really roundabout ways. He's got hypoglycemia, hyponatremia. He can hyperlot too, even calcemia. His rap sheet apparently filled out by Dr. Seuss. But nice. There it is. It's there. Okay, Chris. We've got our suspects. You've seen the 12 lead along with everyone else. And now Dave gets a chance to see it as well. So Jeff announces that the 12 lead says STEMI. Dave looks at the 12 lead, and to them, this really wasn't a slam dunk STEMI, but it certainly was a suspect that seemed to easily explain the patient's condition, more so than any of the other suspects that they encountered. And so they went with it. They did note that there was a high heart rate of about 125 and the like wide rhythm, but they felt that the rate was likely compensation for the hypotension and that the width could be explained by the pacer or some sort of like conduction delay. So Dave brings Uniform Blue along just kind of due to the severity of the patient's condition. So it will be Uniform Blue, Dave, and Jack in the back. Jeff, of course, jumps up front to drive.
Okay.
So there are a couple hospitals that they can go to, but they depart towards the STEMI capable hospital. That's about 20 minutes or so away from them, from where they are, heading code 3. There was a closer hospital, but this one didn't come with a cath lab. If we have a monitor that's saying STEMI alert, and we're going to call this a STEMI, let's go to the STEMI capable hospital instead of the closer one that doesn't have those services. So they were on scene, by the way, for a total of 10 minutes. So in quick order, they do run another 12 lead about 2 minutes after the first one. And that one doesn't say acute MI on it, but it still looks exactly the same. And it says, consider an MI. And so they went, yep, okay. The patient is in short order given 325 milligrams of aspirin and is able to chew them up. The patient does have defibrillator plaids paste on them due to the determination that this is a probable STEMI. Unfortunately, the intern did miss their IV attempt, so Dave moves to start one. Dave does establish an 18-gauge IV, and they quickly start a 500-milliliter bag of normal saline wide open.
Okay. Really quick.
Oh, yes, go on.
Any reason normal saline over LR?
In their protocol, it says for patients in like with a STEMI, they want to go with normal saline. So,
all right.
The crew does troubleshoot the SpO2. They're trying different fingers and, you know, devices, and this continues, by the way, throughout kind of the transport, but to no avail. So they decide to add a non-rebreather mask with a high flow O2 onto the 6 liters per minute being given by the nasal cannula. So they've got, you know, just a shit ton of oxygen going into this guy's face. They do tell Jack, hey, all right, you didn't get the IV, but hey, could you auscultate a manual blood pressure just so we can, you know, really be sure that his blood pressure is as low as it, you know, we believe it is. Uniform Blue gives an early STEMI report to the hospital. And while some hospitals in their area do accept transmitted 12 leads, this one doesn't. So they are not able to transmit it ahead.
Okay.
They do check a CBG or BGL off their IV catheter, and it's found to be 200 milligrams per deciliter or 11.1111 forever millimoles.
Okay.
All right. So everyone catches up on their tasks, and the intern confirms a low blood pressure, lower than the monitor. And that's even with about 300 milliliters of saline in. I believe the rate or the number that they gave was about 70 over 40.
Okay. That's not good.
Yeah.
So, confirmed. It's fucked up.
Yeah. The patient still appears cool, pale, diaphoretic, and their mentation hasn't changed either. So Dave suggests to the group, what if we add in norepinephrine along with the fluids? And everyone kind of goes like, yeah, that's probably a good idea. So they establish another 18-gauge IV, while Uniform Blue mixes up the 4 milligrams of norepinephrine into the different 500-milliliter bag of normal saline. By the way, they don't have they don't carry 250-milliliter bags at their service.
No worries.
This service does use an IV pump, but the IV pump, they can't get it to work. It keeps giving off an error message that the crew just wasn't able to resolve, despite multiple attempts. So they use a 60-drop set, and they shoot for one drop per second, which actually equals about 8 micrograms per minute. So they initiate that on the new IV, and they're giving it in conjunction with the normal saline that's going in. And at the time it started, they think they have about 350 mils in. Pretty quickly, the patient seems more respondent, though they are still pale, cool, and diaphoretic, and still reporting chest pain. Vitals are taken, and this is about 12 minutes into the transport, with the norepinephrine just started. So the rate is 125, still the rhythm that you see, that you have in your hand there. The non-invasive blood pressure is 93 over 53, the respirations are 24, and the end tidal is 13. So with the busy work done, the crew starts really kind of reviewing the clues that they've gathered to make sure they're not missing anything. Again, the monitor said STEMI, but sometimes high rates and conduction problems like right bundle branch blocks, for instance, can trigger some monitors into false positives. So they're just kind of reviewing those details again. So, you know, despite the low mechanism, the patient is elderly. And so the crew want to make sure, like, hey, we're really, like, let's double check and make sure they're not missing any signs of trauma. So they listen to lung sounds to, like, rule out a potential tension pneumo. Once again, they really kind of, like, assess and palpate the chest and abdomen, which remain unremarkable. Lung sounds, by the way, were diminished in the bases clear up top. But, you know, they said, like, hey, this is why we're going code 3 on a road. So they might have been more clear than, you know, like, we could appreciate. And with the possibility of the unresolved pneumonia, you know, sepsis remains a strong player. You know,
it does.
Also, It also explains the signs and symptoms, but they decide they need more data. And so Dave is able to get a better timeline from, like, of the chest pain complaint and some pertinent patient history, as the patient's now, like, a little more lucid and alert, although, again, still not great. So the patient reports that they had an acute, like, onset of chest pain while driving the vehicle. Pain is on the left side of his chest and is still ongoing. The patient does report that they have a pacemaker, but they say the pacemaker was placed because they have a history of going into ventricular tachycardia.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Side note, this new evidence does prompt a re-examination of the 12 lead. And I imagine Dave interrogating Roger VTAC Kent in the interrogation room, like, so what's a guy like you doing on a scene like this, VTAC? I hope there's like a one-way mirror and like a big unnecessary light. Maybe the offer of a cigarette. Cigarette VTAC. Yeah.
Again, thirsty and get you something to drink.
Yeah. Yeah, you know what? Two coffees, uniform. Two coffees.
There you go.
All right. But honestly, Dave didn't feel that the evidence on hand supported this being VTAC, supporting like VTAC being his Kaiser Sosa, you know, the main culprit behind this patient's condition. We're going to have to include spoilers. I just realized. Jesus. All right. You know what? If they haven't seen it by now, fuck them. It's a good movie.
I actually haven't seen it.
Oh, holy shit.
I've never made it all the way through. So, but it's okay. It's okay. Don't worry about it.
Wow. You should cut that out because I'm judging you fucking hardcore right now.
Nah, it's all fine. It's all fine. At least I know how you're really feeling. So will everybody else.
Yeah. All right. So, there were a couple reasons that they don't feel like VTAC is at play. The rates in the 120s, which they felt was more of a compensatory heart rate for the blood pressure versus like the rate being the cause of the low blood pressure. And they also felt like it only looked like VTAC in the precordial leads and not really in like the limb leads, and specifically lead two. But the patient is able to provide more like medical history. They have a history of hypertension. They have a history of a previous MI. They have the AICD pacemaker placed. They have the recent bout of pneumonia, and the patient doesn't recall medications, has no allergies. So it's about 6 minutes later, and these are the last set of vitals. So we're about 18 minutes into the transport. The full 500 of normal saline has gone in, norepi is still going in. The heart rate's about 125. The blood pressure's 95 over 62. The end-tidal CO2 is 20. And the respirations are still in the like 20 to 26 per minute range. The SpO2, despite all the continued attempts to make it work, still isn't reading. So a few moments later, they arrive at the destination hospital. They bring the patient into the ER, and chaos ensues. There are multiple teams that have been awaiting the arrival. You've got the emergency department team, the trauma team, and the cardiology team. But first, Chris, which of our suspects do you think is the primary life concern to our patient?
Well, so which one do I think is the, like, which one do I think caused the patient's condition? Well, I think to really answer that question, I kind of have to define what I think the condition is.
Okay.
I think that's kind of an important part, because I pretty much, yeah. I think what we're treating here is VTAC. I think this is a ventricular dysrhythmia. I admit I'm on board that the 120s does seem low for VTAC. I totally get that. The reason I think that this is VTAC, and you're not going to like my reasoning, Spence. I don't know if our listeners are going to like my reasoning. I may get strung up for this. When I look at it, the rate isn't terribly high, but when I start looking for markers of other things, such as when you're looking at things like hyper-K, or when you're looking for things like a STEMI, for example, and there could be an MI going on here, but I don't think we're able to tell because of what we have is actually, I think these are, this is a tachydysrhythmia that is originating from the ventricles. And the reason being is that in my own experience, when you have things like, let's just use a STEMI for an example, you'll have, it will look different in different leads, but there's usually some sort of predictable method to the madness there. Like, you know, like if you have, you know, ST elevation in some leads, you should have depression in the reciprocal leads, you know, in like a STEMI. There should be some way to make sense of this. And so when I hear kind of comments from them and what I see is like, well, it doesn't look like VTAC, you know, it only looks like VTAC in the precordial leads, but in the limb leads, it looks like something else. Well, what fits that profile?
Yeah.
Almost nothing that I can think of. And so when things stop making sense, that's when I kind of go to, like, all right, what are the things that go wrong to the heart that don't pay attention to any rules? And that is when you have foci, random foci, because the problem with the heart, the bent, one thing that makes the heart work really well is that each individual cardiac cell has its own ability, in theory, has the potential, to generate its own impulse. They all have a certain level of automaticity. The problem with that is that really truly means, depending on how sick the heart is and what's going on with the heart, any one of those cells can suddenly be a pacemaker now. And when that happens, you don't know what it's going to look like. And so when I have a wide complex dysrhythmia that doesn't really seem to follow rules, where like, because some of these don't even make sense. They almost look like a backwards STEMI. Like I'm looking at like V2, V3, V4, V5. If I flip that around, it would look like an ST elevation MI. It would look like a tombstone, but it's not. It's backwards. And that doesn't mean anything to me. And so when I start looking at the precordial leads looking like one thing and the limb leads looking like something else, and it's wide complex and it's fast and my patient is symptomatic, I don't know what else to call it, but ventricular or wide complex tachycardia.
Yeah.
And so, and I'll tell you that the God's honest, I don't know what's causing this patient's wide complex tachycardia. And I don't think you can. I think there's an entire, it's entirely possible that they are septic and we have a sick heart that is just going to be prone to getting sicker. They have a history of going into VTAC, which to me is a big, big thing in there. And so if I'm going to make somebody, so I would say septic is probably most likely in the sense that like, okay, you have a history of being sick. You have a history of going into VTAC. Now we're going to put an increased cardiac workload on your already super sick heart. And it's kind of like, yeah, it's going to go into VTAC again. You know, like it seems like a probable thing. What it kind of boils down to this, and I say this on the show from time to time, is as long as I'm seeing that on the monitor, exactly what's causing it just isn't my primary concern until I can see more. So my problem is this EKG completely obstructs my ability to see if there's a STEMI present, to see, well, I guess that would be my other thing is fucking MI Keaton.
Yeah, no, so for sure. And it, that, like you
that's
said,
my reasoning.
It could be all three of them for sure. But
yeah, it could be all of them. But
this one's an even more special.
By the way, if you say there's a fucking hole in the chest, I'm gonna be like, God damn it.
Well, yeah, then there was the hole in the chest. But
yeah,
now so let's go into pretty what sure happened. So the patient is moved over to the emergency department bed, and what happens next is like described best as. It was like watching one of those like how not to run a scene videos that the AHA puts out.
Yeah,
because people were like talking and shouting over each other. No one seemed to be leading because no one knew who was going to like be leading. You know, it's like the trauma's taking a step back, emergency's taking a step back, cardiology is like, well, I mean, we guess things should happen here too. By the way, neurology got added because the patient like seemed to briefly seize, and I'm suspecting like this is a tonic-clonic movement that like can happen with hypotension or like syncope. But it doesn't matter. The patient was given Ativan and then defibrillated instead of cardioverted while the crew watched. The patient did go into a prolonged systole, prompting someone to like ask like, hey, should we start chest compressions? Well, others started like, oh fuck, we gotta intubate this guy. But thankfully, before anybody really like does any of that, the patient becomes pulsatile and went into a narrow sinus rhythm at a rate of about 80 beats per minute.
Now, is this in response to the electricity or is this just kind of random?
This is after they were cardioverted into a systole and then the heart restarted. Normal sinus rhythm. Cardiology left at that point because, well, this isn't a STEMI. And neurology and trauma didn't stick around either. I'm imagining there was like a post-conversion 12 lead done, but Because
we don't have it.
There is a incidence of like VTAC being a part. Like the reason people go into VTAC is because they're having an MI. So you mm-hmm. know, like so I'm assuming. I hope that was the case that they went like, all right, let's do a 12 lead again, and then we'll take off. But yeah, maybe. So they did find out later the patient was stabilized shortly after, and they were taken off of fluid and their pressors. They also found out that the patient still had the pneumonia, but they don't know if it was like, you know, better or worse than previous. Just like, yep, they were also still had pneumonia. And they weren't able to get lab values or other details, which I had been hoping for, and we'll touch on that in a moment. But based on what we have, Roger VTAC Kent was the problem. He was the suspect that was causing all of this. So that's the call, man.
All right. So, God, this is actually a really good call. And I want to say, like, this is kind of one of those things. So I called it VTAC, but I'm going to point this out. I have the ability to, one thing, like we talk about. So Spencer and I, we're not geniuses. I'm just going to point that out there. It probably seems like we nail this all the time. Keep in mind, we get to review these calls after the fact when we know they're fucked up because they're coming to us. Like that says a lot. Yeah. And it's actually like one of the advantages to like working on a flight program too, is you almost always know the patients get, like you almost always know to like really go deep and like really look for the super sick thing because you got called in the first place because someone else couldn't figure it out. So like, you always know it's going to be hard, and doing this show is the same thing. We always know something's going to be askew. So it may seem like I'm like, oh yeah, it's VTAC. But when you get out there in the field and you do see it, because the problem with this VTAC is it does look like something organized. Like it does look like something a little, it doesn't look like the typical American Heart Association VTAC where it just looks like a bunch of fingernails or tombstones next to each other. It looks like a backwards tombstone. In some leads, which is nothing. So me being calm here, you know, behind a microphone, it's really easy to be like, okay, well, that doesn't make sense to me. So I guess I'd call it VTAC. It is super easy. So I don't blame them for not jumping on the VTAC right off the bat, because it teases you. It's like it wants you to find something in there because there are things to look at. It's just none of it makes a ton of sense. And then again, the rate is like 120. So I totally get that.
And we'll talk about that for sure. We'll go into this because I've experienced this, the same phenomenon that this gentleman has gone through. Dave has gone through. So, yeah.
All right. So quick call summary. See if I get this right with all these fucking suspects and characters. EMS crew goes to an SUV off the road in a neighboring service area in a muddy ass field. They arrive, find a SUV with super minimal damage, but a ways off the road. One occupant, totally fine. The other occupant just looks like shit. As the one guy said, he looks like NREMT sick. The crew move the patient to the ambulance. They get some vital signs. They find the patient to be pre-tachycardic. Their blood pressure sucks. They're breathing a little bit fast and they're kind of slow to respond. 12 lead comes back and says, STEMI. And the crew starts transporting towards the closest cath lab under the impression this is going to be a STEMI. In route, they get IVs, which is great. They start some fluids. Awesome. They end up starting some pressors, as well. We'll kind of talk about that treatment path later on. Or I'm going to anyway, which they have to calculate out because their pump doesn't work. Quick break from doing the end all call summary here, guys. Before we get a bunch of people commenting and saying things like, oh, that's why you always got to check your equipment out. Pumps.
They don't care.
Pumps. They don't care. My flight program thankfully now has brand new pumps that I just don't have these problems with. But before we got these, like, there were pumps just like, all right, hey, everything turns on, seems good in the morning, I'm familiar with my equipment. And then sometimes it's like, hey, random error you've never seen before, first time you're ever going to see it when you turn me on now. I'm without more information, all I'm going to say to this crew is, I feel you. That shit sucks, and it will happen. So yeah, no, equipment fails.
The pump decided, it's like, you know what? It's 9:46, and if you'd tried it at 9:45, I would have worked for you.
Yeah, but you know what? I like my numbers ending in fives or zeros, and you ended in six, you son of a bitch. I am going to say this. I want to commend the crew briefly here for being like, you know what? Pump's broken. We're smart enough to go the alternative. So good on you. Because a lot of people really, it's easy to crutch on that pump. To do all your min math calculations. So honestly,
or to crutch on the listeners who come in and be like, hey man, you totally fucked up that math. Yeah.
Yeah, because that actually did happen on an episode where we did the math wrong and someone called us out, which was I've helped out for. So I commend the crew for two things. One, knowing how to push past the pump and manually do the calculations. And two, not letting us know what the calculations are so we have no opportunity to fuck them up. All right, but they do get the blood pressure up. They get the blood pressure back up to the 90s, but the patient still looks sick and still has a chest pain, but they're a little bit quicker to respond now, which is a good thing. They get to the ED. There's a lot of chaos. Ultimately, the patient does get defibbed instead of synchronized cardioversion from their pulsatile VTAC into a sinus rhythm, and they subsequently recover from that. We don't have any information on necessarily what caused the VTAC, but it sounds like they have a history, so maybe it's just, you know, the old usual suspects.
Here's what I love about this episode. I do love the problem solving. I love that they really did. And I think, like, you know, they had a teamwork approach. They really, like, tried to stay on top of it. The errors here arose out of just, like, educational aspects. And that's, you know, like, and everybody's going to encounter that shit. And so this isn't, like, this shouldn't in any way, like, say, like, oh, man, these guys fucked up.
They actually did a really good job.
Yeah, they did a great job. It's just those educational pieces that I've learned because I also fucking hit this pothole myself in the field. And so, like, we'll be able to touch on that. But, yeah, what about you, man?
Yeah, this is kind of where, like, look, like, being a paramedic, like, you have to have a certain you have to have skill in diagnosis, or as we call them, field impression, because we wouldn't want to have the same things Dr. House. So because this crew exhibited everything that I like to see in a paramedic, the constant turning over stones, the constant reevaluating of a patient, you know, they had an equipment hiccup and they pushed past it. What I really liked is they got you guys know this is gold to me. They got the triple Qs over triple Qs for a blood pressure. And they said, hey, and then when it came back with another blood pressure that was low, they said, okay, let's confirm that. And then, of course, they confirmed and be like, yeah, it's fucked. So like that. I love that. Like, this is the kind of crew that, even though I do disagree with their treatment plan based on the 12 lead, this is the kind of crew you want responding on you and your family, because they've got it down in the sense that, like, they've got that good sense of, you know, how to keep evaluating a patient, how to push past boundaries and those kind of things. Unfortunately, where things went a little bit wrong, I think, is ultimately their interpretation of the EKG, which is not an easy EKG to interpret. All around, like, this is a good crew. They just got dealt a kind of a shitty hand. And so I think, you know, if you don't mind, let's kind of dive into some of the discussion time here.
Yeah,
and let's kind of start with that EKG. So you had said that there are other hospitals in the system that you can transmit an EKG to, correct?
Yeah. And by the way, the hospital that they ended up transporting to is even outside the service area of the neighboring area, like the neighboring hospital, neighboring district. So it's even a farther, like, like twice removed from theirs. It is frustrating, like, in this day and age where everybody can transmit, like, to have hospitals that aren't.
Especially if you're an interventional cath lab, you know, that's kind of having the ability to receive transmitted EKGs is paramount. And I would say if you work at a hospital right now and you are an interventional cath lab, or you otherwise feel your hospital would benefit from being able to transmit EKGs, your best resource, obviously past your own staff, but in terms of what it takes to get that rolling, is contact the agencies that respond in your area. Because the agencies that respond in your area, depending on how many hospitals are nearby, have had to work with each of the individual hospitals to test equipment to make it work. And so they're going to be pretty familiar with the different solutions. And I know that's what's happened in the areas that you and I work at, Spence, where there's where we can transmit 12 leads. A lot of times it comes up to the agencies doing the transmit to help you get up and running. And it's usually a very cost-effective method to get it done. So it's... there are requirements. I mean, obviously, there's requirements in terms of transmitting medical information, but it is really helpful, and it really would have been helpful in this case. So I see that there's probably a system improvement that could have happened there for this difficult 12 lead that really could have changed the outcome for the patient. I mean, ultimately, actually, the outcome for the patient was good, but I would say probably could have gotten on that train sooner. Yeah. So Yeah, that's because there was some initial doubt that it was the STEMI in the first place, which.
Yeah, I think they went with it, and then they're kind of like, you know, like, hey, is it a STEMI or is it not? There, you know, I don't think Dave was completely convinced that it was, but they did say, like, it seemed like, you know, the monitor saying it, and, you know, I have a hard time arguing with the monitor, and that's me knowing what I'm talking, you know, knowing pretty well what I'm talking about when it comes to 12 leads, especially like STEMI 12 leads.
Right.
You know, I have a hard time when it comes to that fact too, when the monitor's like, this is a STEMI. And I'm like, I think you're fucking wrong. But, you know, it's still very uncomfortable. And, you know, and it did explain, you know, like it easily could explain what was happening. So I can totally see, you know, like, but, and again, like if they're if you were able to transmit, then you'd say like, hey guys, the monitor's saying STEMI, but I don't know. I feel like, what do you think? And then the hospital, you know, like then a doctor could have contacted and been like, hey, so let's start with treating I think this is VTAC. Like, why don't we treat this rate and like see if they cardiovert out of it? Cause like, and then that could have, you know, that would have sparked that conversation earlier had that been a thing, but it wasn't. You know, that's you know, a system failure that contributed on this call in a way.
I agree.
Any other system failures that you can identify? I didn't think of any more, but
no, not really off the top of my head. I mean, I think, you know, in terms of our exposure to the system and the information we got with this call, I mean, that's kind of the only real system factor that really kind of plotted up. I mean, there are probably system issues present at the receiving hospital based on how they ran that code or ran that patient when things came in. With the insanity, but I don't really have enough information to comment on there. I will say it kind of reeked of a leaderless situation with no strong PIC, which that's not on our crew, by the way, that's on the receiving hospital.
For sure.
You know, cause I mean, you could try and be PIC in an ER that thinks you're wrong and let it roll, but there's some system issues there at the hospital, but there's not enough information in today's call to really dig into that. So
fair enough. All right. Well, then they get dispatched and the pregame en route. This is the standard sort of discussion that you have when you have like a new person. You're like, all right, how much of this do you already know? You know, like,
right.
Like, yeah. These are the blinky blinks. That's the siren maker. And, have you ever done EMS before?
Right. Well, cause you do get a lot of people to do the zero to hero route where we've, you know, where they've done the classes, you know, they are, you know, they're an EMT and certification only. They haven't actually practiced it as an EMT. And I would say this, I'm not being discouraging the people who take that route, like more power to you. I hope you do well. But you do have an additional challenge ahead of you. And that is, when you get out to the field, you don't have field experience to go along with, because if you get onto the field, you're learning everything all at once. You're learning operations, how to sit in the back of a moving ambulance, how to talk to patients you've just met on top of your new paramedic scope of practice that you've added into that. So you have an extra hurdle, but by all means, like, don't let anyone tell you that you can't be just as good as the people who have experience. You absolutely can. Just, you know, you got an extra challenge, but you know, if you keep listening to our show, you'll get there. I think the pregame was good in the sense of that they, you know, I don't know if this was on the way to the call, but they, you know, the FPI knew what their role was going to be. And, you know, that's always a good thing to have. It sounded like they did a little bit of pregame in the sense that they were like, oh, it's probably be a cancel. It's not the best pregame, but
you know, it's also probably, you know, like, I don't know, man, I'd see the same thing sort of like, if like, oh, car off the road, no one's injured, you know, especially if I'm in an ambulance and I'm like, oh, good, I can go finish my chart. You know, that's the instinct I have. But you're right. You're like, to your point, it's like, yeah, but you know, then you show up and you might have to scramble like this, but you know, I don't really know. Yeah.
But they didn't really seem to have to scramble much. I mean, I will say it sounds like I'm just giving them a nonstop back rub here, but, you know, kind of more kudos to the crew of like, oh, hey, this isn't what we think it is. Let's move with the new data. And good.
And they rolled with it.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, there was no pregame, but it didn't really seem to set them back. So solid.
Boom. Well, then let's get into when they arrive and the assessment. So they arrive and they get handed a, you know, a strip which shows lead two. And it, lead two, from like what I looked, I mean, it looks wide and ugly. And, you know, and that's from the 12 lead we have. But I mean, I wouldn't say it's a slam dunk for VTAC either. You know, it certainly, like, looking at that would make me very curious, especially if they're like, oh, they have a pacer, and but I don't see any pacer spike or like arrows that are typically present with the pacer. That would make me very curious as a, you know, just, but that's right. Me who's the nerd on, you know, EKG shit. So
yeah, I'm actually gonna admit, I forgot you said it was a pacer, kind of like I forgot the chief complaint and that first blood pressure. But I forgot that you said it was a pacer, but I mean, again, like I didn't look at it and see a paced rhythm because I didn't see any pacer spikes or anything. Yeah. There, but yeah, know. Yeah, and then also they picked up on the skin signs pretty quick, which is great. Skin yeah. signs sucked, mentation sucked, and it really helped the crew to like pinpoint the fact that the patient was really sick, like NREMT sick, like I said earlier. I agree with getting the patient into the ambulance early, especially because there's mud, and we've already talked about my how much I like mud. Especially, okay, but there's one thing I hate more than mud is yeah. when certain responders, now it wouldn't work for this one because I want to say like the patient was like quite a ways away from the road, right? But yeah. I hate it when it's outside and I'll see like someone struggling to make a path to where our feet don't get muddy by putting the ambulance bath blankets down over the mud. I've seen this several times where like all of a sudden you look, it's like, hey guys, it's really muddy. I put some of your bath blankets down so we wouldn't get the shoes. I'm like, no, like, cause here's what's going to happen. We're all still going to get muddy because that's a tiny little path and we're going to carry them on the backboard and we're going to be tripping on that to try and get the patient out. And now you've just ruined all my bath blankets. All right. This happened once and I'm still mad about it. It doesn't happen all the time. But
what am I going to use to stem the flow of vomit to the front of the ambulance now?
Exactly. As I make my dam, my Hoover dam. Anyway. So yeah. Perfect. And so, yeah, but yeah, also like, working not just the mud, but it's a cramped like driver's side of an SUV where it's really hard yeah. to like examine people. And yeah. I could see myself being like, no, like let's get him out of here because we just can't do any good for this guy right here. Yeah. So I'm down with that. We've talked about that too in like codes. Like don't like move patients to where you can actually help them. So then they get the patient in and they start work on figuring out like just what's going on. They got a patient who appears to be in some kind of shock, and they got to figure out why. So they do have a list of their usual suspects with the story. And I think all the considerations they had throughout the call were good considerations. But the 12 lead they performed on their monitor comes back and then says like STEMI alert. So,
yeah. Which, and yeah. Chris, I don't know about you, but like the STEMI alert frustrates me, as I've said earlier, like it just has those like false positives with monitors. You know, especially like right. in my experience when they encountered like right bundle branch block type patterns. And it, like, even I have, like I said, I have a really hard time saying like, this is not a STEMI, especially if I had a patient who was presenting like this, like complaining of chest pain. So like, to me, it really kind of makes sense to me that the crew would run with like that as their primary suspect is like what's potentially killing our patient right now.
It's almost good.
Yeah. Especially if you're discounting the possibility of this being VTAC for right. reasons we'll go into.
So for me, it's kind of the trauma system entry conundrum, right? Like yeah. someone says, hey, I want to make them a trauma entry. It's really hard to step back from that because when you're talking about STEMIs or sepsis alerts or trauma entries or stroke teams or all those things, you're turning on a switch at the ER when you make that call, right? Like yeah. you're getting something ready to go. And so it's really hard to make the declaration that this is not a STEMI and to not stand up the cath lab, because not standing up the cath lab can have a negative impact on the patient. And so yeah. that is, yeah, you know, like that is kind of that's a conundrum here. And so I would point out this, like there isn't a downside to calling this a STEMI in the sense of, I mean, aside from a false start in the cath lab, but there is a downside to not treating the VTAC. So yeah. I'm not going to say like, hey, if it's VTAC, call it a STEMI just to get everyone ready. I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't necessarily do that. I would treat the VTAC as it is. But it's one of those things where it's like, hey, if you started out calling it a STEMI and they were like, no, I'm going to treat the VTAC, like, no harm, no foul. Because for all you know, you're going to treat the VTAC and be like, oh shit, there's a massive MI. Once you take the VTAC away and it goes back to the normal conduction pathway. Yeah. So yeah, there's nothing wrong with, you know, it's not a bad thing that they called this a STEMI. It was just, they should have treated the VTAC.
Yeah.
So.
Well, yeah. So then let's talk about the VTAC, because that's really sort of the crucial problem of this call. There, I said the word. All right.
Boom.
So, and here's why I'm actually not too judgy about like this, because like my first reaction when I got this 12 lead and it was sent to me blinded was, ooh, I wonder what their potassium is. Or, and then followed by like, or, oh, do they take sodium channel blockers? And here's the reason why. It's a very, very wide, complex QRS. And when I, you know, my rule is like, if it's very, very wide, consider a metabolic, you know, disorder that's prolonging that extensively.
And the rate.
Yeah, the slow rate. So I'm going like, you know, like that's fast for hyperkalemia, but you know, I've seen hyper-K, that's pretty fast. And I've also seen like sodium channel, you know, like sodium toxicity cause a fast rate with a wide complex. So I was going like,
But, fast for hyper-K, but slow for VTAC.
Yeah, exactly. But then like second, then they're like, yeah, wait, nope, potassium's fine. Then it's, you know, it's like, okay, well then I would assume this is VTAC. But that's really because I follow a very simple heuristic when it comes to wide complex tachycardias. And I'll touch on that later. Yeah, but here's the thing. Dave showed this to a lot of their medics, and once we got the call, I also showed it to a group of, you know, my paramedic friends. There wasn't a consensus among most of them. A lot of paramedics didn't think it was VTAC. One was like, that's totally VTAC. And another went like, I don't think so. There's got to be something else going on here. And they kind of went on the metabolic rabbit hole that I went on. But here's why this is VTAC. We're going to hit on all those arguments in order. So the first thought of like, hey, it's too slow to be VTAC. I can see their point. There are quite a few sources that actually do like offer different ranges of VTAC. You know, Life in the Fast Lane, their like CCC page says, yeah, VTAC greater than 130 beats per minute. Other sources have been like, yeah, it's greater than 148.
It's a very specific number. 147? Yeah. No. 149? Yes.
We'll get into that too. Here's the thing. For simplicity's sake, tachycardia greater than 100. Even VTAC. And there is an article in the Circulation Journal from back in August of 2005, which supports the incidence of what they describe as slow ventricular tachycardia. And by the way, those are the ones that came up with the like greater than 148.
Gotcha.
Normal VTAC. These other ones, those are slow. But they found in their study that about 30% of patients with AICDs had incidents of slow ventricular tachycardia during their study period. And again, they defined slow VTAC as 101 to 148.
Now, you said this guy had a pacemaker. Did he also have an AICD or was it was a combo?
It was an AICD combo, but primarily it sounds like they had it because they had bouts of ventricular tachycardia.
So chances are he's got a pacemaker AICD combo primarily because he may need to be defibrillated, not because he needs to be paced.
That would be my assumption. Yeah.
Okay. Sounds good.
Now, again, like, so they define slow ventricular tachycardia as 101 to 148. And this guy falls into that. I think because he's got the device and he's got this slower rate. Now, again, like, with that rate, I tend to think more metabolic. If I, like, see the slower rate with these really wide complexes, you know, they're great. The QRS is greater than one big box. And to me, that says, like, ooh, metabolic. That's, you know, that's just what's ingrained in my head. You know, like, I'd be compelled to try and, like, treat the potential for the metabolic, like, you know, like, ooh, is this hyper-K? We can't really get a history. We'll treat with some calcium. But, like, failing that, if I have an EKG that shows a slower-than-expected VTAC rhythm and nothing else seems to, like, explain it, then I'm going to treat it as VTAC.
Now, I kind of want to point something out really quick.
Yeah.
A lot of people may be looking at this rate and kind of have this thing is, like, you know, one of the main reasons that tachycardic dysrhythmias cause a drop in blood pressure is because the diastole phase isn't long enough for the ventricles to fill with blood. So when systole occurs, it doesn't have much to push out. And so you might be looking at this rate and being like, oh, that's kind of too slow of a rate to really be causing this kind of hypotension. But one of the things that I want to point out with VTAC is that because we don't have ventricles contracting in the way they normally should, the dysrhythmia itself can actually cause poor cardiac output.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Because the atria aren't filling the ventricles like in that coordinated fashion, to which, as you pointed out, because you made
I don't even remember it now. Yeah, this was a while ago. Oh man,
with the filling, yeah, with the extra oomph that you get from those atria filling, that atrial kick, you know,
yeah,
pushing more blood into the ventricles, which then gets pushed out. Yeah, no, exactly.
Even these slower rates, you still have issues with the ventricles filling and the contractility.
That's a really good point, man. I'm glad you brought that up. Here's the one that struck chords with me. It doesn't look like VTAC in all the leads.
100% with you. Yeah, enters are like this one hitting a button. Yeah.
Yeah. I have said that very thing myself. In fact, I was on a call in which I was like, they're like, yeah, we're treating it for VTAC. And I'm like, well, it looks like VTAC in these leads, but not in these ones. And they, like, everybody was moving on ahead. And they're like, all right, 150, AMIO is going in. And I was just like, okay, well, I hope we're not wrong when we get to the hospital, because, like, Jesus. But I was wrong. Here's the thing. And Dave said, like, hey, look, it looks like VTAC in some leads, but not all. And specifically in lead two, they felt it didn't. But here's the general rule for 12 leads, that I've learned over the years. It's like, if you see what looks like a really wide complex tachycardia in some of your leads, you probably have a wide tachycardia in all your leads. You're just not able to see it from the angle that you're looking at. So you really do need to, like, scrutinize the rest of the 12 leads. For example, like, sometimes P waves aren't visible in, like, all the leads. It's actually, like, V1 is the most common spot to find P waves.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, if you look at the rest of your 12 lead and you're like, man, I don't see any P waves, but you see P waves preceding each QRS in lead one or V1, then you wouldn't be like, well, it's sinus rhythm in there, but not in any of the rest. Like, you'd be like, all right, it's a sinus rhythm. We just can't see them. Going back to the 12 lead, like, another thing is, like, for example, right bundle branch blocks can be tricky because, like, the QRS in some leads will appear, like, isoelectric, meaning that the QRS can seem narrow in some, but, like, wide in others. And then that's really frustrating because you actually have to look at those leads, like, look at the other leads and kind of line up where everything falls to figure out, like, oh, is this actually a T wave, or is this ST depression, or is this just a really wonky QRS that just has the, like, gives off the look of a T wave or a depressed S wave or ST elevation? That shit happens. And really frustrating for me, like, it you can have a right bundle branch block that looks like a high lateral STEMI just on its own, just because of, like, how the QRS, like, plays out. So again, like, if you see it wide in one lead, it's wide in all the other leads. You know, it's the widest lead you find is the width of your QRS.
Right.
That's the general rule that I've learned. If somebody has information that counters that, send it my way, because, But here's the other thing. VTAC, despite your medic school with their, like, standard VTAC papers, VTAC has a fucking ton of presentations. And, like, we're taught the easily recognizable ones for school. But if you get onto sites like Life in the Fast Lane, for example, you can see there are some really tricky ones that do not scream VTAC. I mean, they seem weird and you're like, I'm uncomfortable. Like, reading this, but they don't say, like, VTAC right away. And so there are some who are also going to add in, like, hey, well, like, why don't they use tools? There are, like, these tools that can be used by providers to rule in VTAC. You know, like, for example, if you're trying to treat, you know, like you're like, ooh, is this an SVT with like a aberrancy, like the, you know, left bundle branch block or right bundle branch block that's making it seem wide and like VTAC-y? Or is this VTAC? There are those tools, but I don't think they're worth learning in EMS. One, they're not precise enough. They're not exact enough for you to really be sure. And they're often really fucking difficult rules. So Dr. Amal Mattu, the lead instructor on EKG Weekly, they made a, you know, phenomenal argument. Just like, yeah, you know what? The treatments for VTAC will work for SVT. So just treat it as VTAC and save yourself the mental space of trying to like figure it out.
Well, you are actually seeing some municipalities embrace protocols that have amiodarone for narrow complex tachycardias as well.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and in this case, you know, the treatment for this patient would have been, you know, I presume electrical, given that their blood pressure was so garbage.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, and hey, that'll also work for your SVTs if their blood pressure is garbage. So, you know, and that sort of, this is my heuristic is, if it's wide complex tachycardia, if it's a regular wide complex tachycardia and it's really wide, I think metabolic first, just to make sure that I'm not missing anything, because then you'll need to, you know, add something in to counter, you know, to make your treatments work, that stabilizes those, you know, cellular membranes. But like pending that, then it's like, wide complex tachycardia, let's treat it as VTAC and go from there.
Right.
Yeah. And, yeah. So, and those, again, those are pieces that I have picked up just because, you know, like I found myself not, you know, not understanding and failing to grasp why these, you know, like why all these other providers were treating, you know, a patient with weird, wonky EKGs that didn't seem like VTAC in all the leads. You know, this is just things that I've learned as I've encountered it. And so it sounds like Dave's having the same lesson.
Right.
So my treatment plan for this patient, as I said, because I've immediately thought of like hyper-K or like a sodium channel blocker or sodium channel toxicity, would have been, again, to like just slowly give 1 gram of calcium over a few minutes to see if the EKG changes. And then failing that, moving right to cardioverting the patient. So, yeah.
I'll admit, I wouldn't have thought of the calcium. I would have... I would have gone straight to unstable tachycardia. And part of that just because, I mean, it's something that's held over from medic school. And that is like, hey, like, you know, unstable tachycardia, you know, I mean, you skip the antidysrhythmics and you go, you go to the cardioversion, because my assumption is that we need them out of that rhythm. And so I kind of see calcium in my brain. Calcium to me is like, okay, well, are we just replacing an antidysrhythmic with calcium in this case and running into the same problem we shouldn't be if it's a wide complex? But they're kind of assuming that when they write that, they're assuming that it is indeed a ventricular tachycardia that would benefit from amiodarone lidocaine as opposed to a K problem. So yeah, I totally admit I wouldn't have thought of the 1 gram of calcium. I would have just been like, oh, unstable VTAC and gazuba. So
and I would have wasted time with calcium that may not have been necessary, or you know, right. In this case wasn't at all necessary.
Perfect.
Yeah. So there we go. But treatment wise. So obviously they did not treat VTAC, but they did treat for the STEMI and the hypotension that the patient was undergoing. So they went with MI, they got aspirin on board, they, you know, O2, a heavy amount of O2, given that they couldn't get a pulse sat or pulse ox, and the patient was, you know, very sick and shocky looking. Mm-hmm. And they focused on correcting the low blood pressure through like fluids and then moving fairly quickly to pressors. So Chris, what are your thoughts with this treatment plan? Let's take VTAC out of it. Let's say it's an MI. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think it's a pretty good treatment plan for suspected sepsis. I mean, sans putting more fluids in first before moving depressors, that's been found to really help with sepsis. In terms of cardiogenic shock specifically, it's going to kind of depend on what their local protocol is. A lot of protocols do call for limited fluid boluses when a cardiogenic shock is suspected, just purely because if it is cardiogenic shock, you might end up with too much fluid winding up in places it shouldn't go. So I think they kind of gave some conservative, what did they end up giving, a 500 before they went depressors?
So they got 350 in. And I got their protocol page. Their protocol is to give, 250 to 500 times two, checking for lung sounds and making sure pulmonary edema isn't present. Moving to norepinephrine starting at 4.
If this was a cardiogenic shock patient, this is a good treatment plan. And I think they did well. They did well in the sense of it's like, okay, we've got them on here. We're identifying this as cardiogenic shock. I mean, which I guess even if it is VTEC, it is technically cardiogenic shock. But it's for a different reason. But they're saying, basically we have a failing pump is what they're saying. We have a potential STEMI and we don't have the cardiac output, we need to maintain a blood pressure. So what we're going to do is we're going to give some fluid, see if that helps. It doesn't, because they end up rechecking a blood pressure and I believe it's not good after the fluid. And then they start some pressors and they start getting up into the 90s. The patient starts to improve quite a bit in terms of their mentation, which is great. So, no, I would say this is a very solid treatment plan for cardiogenic shock. They did the right things in the sense that they continued their assessment and they continued to reconsider suspects as they went along, especially when they got that little nugget of info of, oh, by the way, the thing you don't think it is... he's had it before, like there's that.
Yeah.
So could be VTEC. And you're like, ah, fuck, there's that. But no, I think this is a great plan for cardiogenic shock.
Yeah. Okay. Perfect. I was sort of in the same line. Initially, I was like, ooh, move to pressors pretty quickly. Cause I think I would have tried to do, the other bolus too. Really just because I don't know, I'm weary to give levofed to patients with an MI. And that's really just like, that might be my own thing. I just might be wrong on my own island, but I get nervous about it.
It's not a bad, the problem is, so you got kind of like two things, right? I mean, you've got, because when you have an MI, like you worry about making the heart work harder, which a lot of our pressors, whether it's, norepi or push dose epi, dopamine, whatever your municipality is given, they all have the potential to do that. Some of them have, less impacts in terms of like heart rate and those kind of things, but almost all of them, by virtue of being a pressor, they are going to cause some amount of vasoconstriction that increases systemic resistance. That's more for the heart to push against. So really, in some way, you're going to increase what the heart has to push against to an extent. Yeah. The hope is that what we're doing is we're saying, all right, but we still have to perfuse the brain and kidneys, because if we don't do that, then they're going to die all the same. So the hope is that you're giving a pressor that will kick the heart up enough to get perfusion to the vital organs, but not so much that we kill the heart in the process, and then no amount of pressors is going to help anything.
And to their point, like their rate seemed good at the 8, because they were getting blood pressures of in the 90s, which that's pretty good indication of like a MAP of 60 plus. I didn't actually calculate the MAPs out, but it seemed like good numbers.
Yeah. the other thing that would kind of go against, giving fluid first is you do have the other issue of if you have a failing heart. In fact, a lot of times cardiogenic shock will present as a breathing problem, because when your left ventricle fails to output, a lot of times the left atria is not able to drain as quickly as it could, and you start getting a fluid back up through the pulmonary arteries, or pulmonary veins rather, back into the lungs. And so you'll have people who will present with pulmonary edema accompanied by a low blood pressure that can be indicative of heart failure. And so adding more fluid to that heart may end up making their pulmonary edema situation worse.
Yeah.
So those are cases where, adding a pressor to the situation can really help, because what we end up doing is we increase that cardiac output by allowing the left ventricle to push blood out of itself and into the system, and then therefore allowing blood to move along from the pulmonary system back to the cardiac system and back on out. But again, you also run into the issue of increasing systemic resistance to where the heart can't push against that either. So anyway, yeah. The moral of the story is go back in time and help your patients to make better life decisions. So
yeah. That's right. Yeah. Like you get one syncopal episode when you drive and then you should not drive anymore. That's not three. Fucking critical, as it turns out.
Oh my gosh.
All right. So, treatment wise, one thing on the assessment, if we're considering sepsis, I don't know that they didn't do this. It just might not have gotten reported to me. So if they did do this, I apologize for making this a critique, but like, I think getting a temperature in a patient like this would have been a good, good thing to do, like you said.
100%. Yeah. Temperatures, I think, in EMS should be as standard as they are in the ER. Because at the ER, they stick a thermometer in everybody that I drop off. Okay, I can't speak for every ER out there. I'm sure some people are going to be like, my ER doesn't, or the ER I turned to doesn't. But I always feel like I go in there, and like it's like as I'm giving a report, it's like you'll see the nurse come in. They get their computer or their napkin, whichever they're going to write on first, ready for report. And while they're doing that, they're sticking a thermometer in someone's mouth. And it really kind of needs to be like the next vital sign we add, because I think we'd be impressed with what we find. But to do that, we'd have to convince EMS agencies to buy worthwhile thermometers.
And that might be a limiting factor here, is like if you have a thermometer that never works, like then of course you're not going to use it, because
there's somebody going to be like, you got the back of your hand, don't you? Anyway, so
well, then I think the only other piece that I'd say is like, I'm really glad they stuck around to one, witness the chaos of the emergency department and be like, and they'd look down at us.
And finally, also
to get the treatments and to see that they worked, and to actually get to like stick around and go like, oh, they cardioverted him out. But that, in a way, they cardioverted him out, and and it changed.
Yeah. I mean, follow up is something we lack. You won't get it unless you seek it out. You know, we've talked about that before. Generally speaking, you won't get it unless you seek it out. So instead of thinking, instead of making assumptions on whether or not you did a good or bad job, stick around and find out if you can. Thanks again, everyone, for listening. Just to kind of summarize, VTAC can come in all shapes and sizes. VTAC is not necessarily just what we were taught in school. It turns out having an AICD, and I did not know this, is awesome, Spencer, can actually cause you to have some slower ventricular rates in there. If you've got a wide complex in one lead, you've got a wide complex tachycardia. That's kind of what that boils down to. The key points to take away, though, that things that went really, really well, don't use all your equipment as a crutch. Learn how to get around that stuff and keep reassessing and keep reevaluating your patients, much like this crew did. So accommodations all around. Don't put blankets down to try and get past mud. It sucks and it's stupid. and of course, always take all of your suspects into consideration and keep reevaluating those suspects. And bear in mind, there is no reason that someone couldn't be having one or all of the suspects on your list. So with that, Spence, anything to add to round off the discussion?
No, man, that was perfect.
Boom.
I love the blanket that got added in. You're like, it didn't happen here, but I'm still mad about it. Fuck it. Don't use a blanket.
And then I had to admit, it only happened once, actually. I've seen it before several times. Actually, it's not true. It happened once. It was stupid. We all just tripped over it. It didn't help. Because I tell you what, you know what's hard to do in mud? Walk in mud. You know what's harder to do in mud? Walk in one very specific path in mud. It's like a fucked up game of Twister while you're holding a patient, except instead of just losing an article of clothing, you drop your patient, depending on the version of Twister you play. Whatever, take us out awkwardly.
All right.
if you can be more awkward than what I said.
M.I. Keaton lights his final cigarette and tosses his match. He knows he's fucked. He now knows it was a setup. He was never going to be the one to kill the patient. He was just a pawn in someone else's game. But maybe this impulse can somehow finish the job? That cigarette's thrown. The impulse travels down the atria towards the AV node and the ventricles. But a figure steps out from the shadows and starts peeing on the impulse Keaton sent. The figure approaches MI and lights their own cigarette. How you doing, Keaton? Keaton lets out a hollow laugh. I can't feel my legs. VTAC. A single gunshot rings out through the night. VTAC will be the one that sends the impulse that will end this patient's life. No one else.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to EMS 2020. Please follow us on social media. We are EMS 2020 Show on Instagram at EMS20/20 on Facebook. If you want your call featured on this show, send it to EMS2020podcast@gmail.com. And yeah, we're out. See you next week.